Good evening and welcome to this Arena RTE Short Story Competition special from the Pavilion Theatre in Dún Laoghaire. A happy little crew we have with us here very clearly tonight. Back last spring, we invited aspiring writers to get to work on a short story and enter our annual competition in honour of Francis McManus. You certainly rose to that challenge. RTE received in the region of 1,500 entries for this year's competition. Our three judges, with some assistance from our very energetic and now tired reading panel, had the onerous task of whittling 1,500 down to a shortlist of just 10. One of those 10 writers will tonight win the ultimate prize of €5,000. There's also a runner-up prize of €4,000 and a third prize worth €3,000, not to mention the accolade of being either the winner or a runner-up in this competition. The stakes are high. The Pavilion Theatre is full of enthusiastic supporters, as you just heard. And we also have our three judges, Neil Hegarty, Claire Kilroy and Kathleen McMahon. And I'm delighted to say that we have all 10 of our shortlisted writers sitting here in the front row of the audience, so that whichever of them has to come up and pick up the prize doesn't have far to go. The competition is open to anyone over 18, living in Ireland or living abroad and holding an Irish passport. And in fact, this year, two of our finalists have flown in from Canada. This morning, at 5:30, they arrived. So if one or other of our writers falls asleep, you'll know it's the Canadian side of the family. One from Scotland as well to be with us for this very special event. All of the shortlisted stories have been broadcast at this stage on RTE Radio 1's Late Date. They are available as podcasts and have been published on rte.ie/culture. Listeners to Arena will have heard six of the shortlisted writers speaking to me on Arena over the past 2 weeks or so, and we will meet the final four here tonight. And the choice as to whether the writer was interviewed in the programme over the past fortnight or tonight was purely down to logistics. It's not an indication of winners or runners-up or anything like that, so you can put that thought right out of your head as well. Let me tell you a little bit more about our judges this evening. Kathleen McMahon has published four novels, including Nothing But Blue Sky, which was longlisted for the Women's Prize for Fiction. Her latest is The Home Scar. Claire Kilroy is the author of five novels. Her most recent, Soldier Sailor, was named the Times Novel of the Year and shortlisted for the 2024 Women's Prize for Fiction. And Neil Hegarty, whose novels include The Jewel and Inch Levels, was shortlisted for the Kerry Group Novel of the Year. Please welcome them this evening. And to name them as the shortlist, in alphabetical order, again, signifying nothing else. Sheila Barrett, Matty Brennan, Ryan Delaney, Sharon Gard, Alexis MacIsaac, Fiona O'Connor, Stephen O'Reilly, Emer O'Toole, David Ralph and Susan Stick. They are the 10 shortest listed writers. They are already winners. We also have in our company this evening actors Rory Nolan and Katrina Niwaruku, who will be reading selections from all 10 stories for us. And we are particularly honoured to welcome Francis McManus's son, Patrick, who is in our audience this evening as well. Now, let us get some initial thoughts from the judges for this year's competition. Start with you, Claire Kilroy, sitting right beside me here on the stage of the Pavilion Theatre. You were due to be with us last year, in fact, and illness stopped you.
COVID, the old dreaded, but
delighted that it didn't.
I got the vaccine 2 weeks ago, so I'm grand here.
Grand. So you didn't affect you this year. Delighted that you're here. Your overall thoughts, Claire, on this year's shortlisted stories, and maybe particular themes that struck you?
There was a lot of, not sexual politics, but men thinking about women and women thinking about men. I actually looked at it, half of them were men contemplating the female world or vice versa in a way that was illuminating of both genders and interesting to all three of us. What was really interesting to me was we saw different things And, you know, it's the exact same text.
Yeah.
But we all read them differently, which shows the layers. Also, we came back to these a few times. So this is our fourth pass on these.
Yeah.
And each time we saw different stuff. And there was, I certainly felt good about our choices.
Well, I feel good about them too, I have to say. I haven't listened to all 10 and read all 10. And that is a different experience as well, reading or listening to them as this competition asks you, Neil, and indeed everybody else to do. What did you think of the standard of the stories that were there this year in particular, Neil?
I thought they were astronomically high. I thought they were strikingly, strikingly high. And it made for a challenging kind of phase in trying to get number one, number two, number three. Everything was so tightly bunched at the end, which is a good problem to have. It's not a complaint by any means.
And Catherine McMahon, I mentioned the idea that there were 1,500 in and around that number of entries. Now, you three didn't have to read all 1,500 by yourselves. You had some help along that. And you've done this before. The process of getting down to a shortlist is quite difficult.
It's really tricky because you have to examine why you like a story, which makes it really interesting. And I think we learn an awful lot about good writing from judging it. And, you know, different stories will have different strengths. It could be the storytelling, the plotting. It could be the use of language. It could be, you know, just some really strong central truth in the story or voice. And the process of the three of us coming together and thrashing that out is great fun, but also quite rigorous because you really have to defend your choices.
Is that a diplomatic way of saying you had loads of rows?
We had massive scraps.
Well, listen, we'll hear about the individual stories shortly indeed. We'll discuss each one, give a few minutes to it, and we'll hear a selection from it as well. But to settle us for a little while before we get into that process, we're going to have some music. I'd like you to welcome brothers Ferdia and Oisin Walsh Pilo and their cellist Julianne Quirk, collectively known as the Finches. Here is a track from their upcoming debut album. It's a song called Waking Up Next to You.
I have been drinking every evening. In the morning, I'd be taken by the blues, because today is the last time that I know I will be waking up next to you. I could be fired from my station. I could be shaken from my head down to my shoes. Then I'd remember nothing can hurt me in the morning when I'm waking up next to you. In the morning, I'm not waking up next to you. In the morning, I'm not waking up next to you.
Yes, the Finches and Waking Up Next to You.
Okay, you're listening to an arena special from the Pavilion Theatre in Dún Laoghaire, the grand final of the RTÉ short story competition in honour of Francis McManus. The front row, as I've told you earlier, is full of 10 slightly nervy writers right now. And our three judges, Neil Hegarty, Claire Kilroy and Kathleen McMahon, have already managed the process of getting 1,500 entries down to just 10 this evening. They're going to get that down to 3. And we're going to look at each of the stories in turn now. We're going to start with The Other Orla by Emer O'Toole, who's coming up to me now. And we decided that we would start with Emer, because Emer is one of the two people who had to fly in from Canada this morning. And we want to get you before you nod off. Why are you in Canada, Emer, first of all?
Working.
Nothing here?
No.
Do you write very short sentences all the time? Or is that just when you're chatting?
I'm verbose.
Well, I'm hoping you might start to be a little bit more verbose anytime you're ready. These two girls of yours in the story, both of them called Orla. Tell us a little bit about them, not just that they're girls in secondary school. I want more than that. And about this chap, posh chap, Dave, that they both have their eyes on.
I might start by saying that I have my own teenage friend called Orla sitting up the back there. So I suppose in lots of ways, the story is informed by that kind of teenage milieu that you find yourself in, where you're kind of, you're, you know, so close to these people you're in school with, and also there's all these little tensions, its own little microcosm. The story is kind of about two girls who are after the same fella, and there's competition, but they also know a lot about him, and so they're both kind of competing for him. But the competition ends up being who can be the most self-effacing, because that's kind of what he's after. And I suppose if I wanted to kind of give it a moral, it would be that often women do that, make themselves small in order to be liked. And I suppose it's something of a morality tale, because one of the Orlas, the other Orla, goes further than you might expect in this particular game.
It's very awkward now, because Orla is sitting up the back. Because I thought there might be a school friend of yours called Emer, and that you'd be telling me that there were two Emers. There was a pal called Emer.
I don't talk to her anymore.
Emer, thanks so much for talking to us, and good luck in the competition this evening. Emer O'Toole. And Katrina Ní Mhuiriceanu is now going to read from the story The Other Orla. And the guy that they're both fancy, by the way, as you will hear here, is a fella called Dave.
Dave walked over to our desk, asked the other Orla if our Bunsen burner was working, and invited us to his mam's 50th birthday. "You know my mam," he said. We did know his mam. "It's her birthday, not this Saturday, the one after, and I've to invite 4 friends, but they can't all be boys, because she says there's nothing festive about 17-year-old boys. That's a joke, like. So I've to invite 2 girls, but Mam doesn't like Siobhan and Emma. Don't tell them." We would not tell them. "And she likes ye," she says. "Maybe because you're the Orlas, like Eva Gimmick. Jarlathan Shocks are coming. I don't know if it'll be any good. You probably have swimming." His palm threatened to erode him from scalp to shoulder. Orla said there was no swimming, and I said we'd ask our parents. We let Dave light the Bunsen burner and carried out her desalination experiment with quaking hearts.
Katrina Ní Mhuiriceanu there, reading from Emer O'Toole's story, The Other Orla. Claire, I we get a sense of it there. This is a pacey and funny story. What struck you about it, Claire Kilroy?
The levels on which it worked. That movement from we, when it's two Orlas and it moves towards I mean, it's two, they're frenemies really, but that humour is throughout, but it's deceptive because these girls are heading towards a cliff face. Like, it gets life and death towards the end, and that tension is sustained. So it's that mixture of comedy and suspense and drama.
Which is exactly what we got from from Emma O'Toole when she spoke to us. Okay, let's move on to story number two, which is Dead Bait by Matty Brennan. Matty spoke to me about this story on the programme on Arena, and he told me that the idea came to him when he saw three men fishing at Doolin Pier a few years ago at about 2 a.m., odd time to be out fishing for sure. He let his imagination loose on that, and before long, the three men were involved in drug smuggling, with our narrator wanting this particular job to be the last time that he'd be involved. It's a very striking story, Neil.
It's a tremendous story. It's such an arresting, menacing story. And because it's a drugs run, you don't think it's really going to be about ethics or any form of sort of morality. But then Matty Brennan, he kind of executes this sort of narrative switchback in the middle of the story, and you realise that in fact it's all about ethics, it's all about morality, and it has this extra terrible sting in its tail.
Right, we listen to a section of the story now read by Rory Nolan. As we said, the story starts on the pier with these three gentlemen. We're going to pick it up now. The narrator leaves, and as he drives home with the haul of drugs in the boot of his car, things start to happen. This is Rory Nolan reading from Dead Bait by Matty Brennan.
I see a gleam of light up ahead, near the turn for the main road. My stomach lurches till I realise it isn't neon blue. It's a vertical stream of pale light, as if someone is shining a powerful torch up to the sky. I slow down, hunch forward, and squint. As I near it, I can make out the shape of a small yellow car. A Fiesta, but it's all wrong, is on its side a mess in the ditch. One headlight is shining upwards, the other is smashed in. I lower the window. There's no sound from its engine. I'm at crawling pace now, inching past the wreckage, when I hear a faint cry. Unconsciously, I brake hard, shift into neutral, and pull up the handbrake. A horse, frail voice is calling out, help.
Rory Nolan reading from Dead Bait by Matty Brennan. You have to read on if you want to find out what happens next. All available on the website, as I said, rte.ie/culture. Let's move on to our third story, Planning the Leftovers by Sheila Barrett. In fact, I spoke to Sheila on Arena the same night that I spoke to Matty Brennan. In this story, it's December the 26th. We're going to hear the opening section of the story read by Katrina Niwaraku shortly. Fiona and Gerard are waiting the arrival home from Chicago of their somewhat wayward son, Kevin. Also in the house on the day are Kevin's sister, Mags, dependable Mags, as they call her, and her daughter, so the granddaughter, Belinda. In fact, it's a little bit into the story that we're going to hear Katrina reading from now. Katrina Niwaraku with Planning the Leftovers by Sheila Barrett.
At 12, the turkey is cooking, covered with strips of bacon. The ham simmers at the back of the cooker. Will it all be spoiled? Kevin loves Christmas food. The doorbell rings. The doorbell? Fiona has anticipated the sure turn of Kevin's key in the lock, his complete and perfect materialization in the hall or the sitting room or up the stairs. She puts Belinda on her feet. Gerard gets to the door first. Kevin's voice. Another voice. A girl's? Fiona can't see until Gerard stands back, waving them in. Why, Kevin looks well. He looks happy. He has a little tidy beard. He's almost plump, Kevin. And the girl? Oh, sweet God. Meet the wife, says her son, with an ecstatic, terrified smile.
It's So some presents can arrive the day after Christmas, clearly, as they do there in Sheila Barrett's story, Planning the Leftovers, read for us by Catherine Niwaraku. Kathleen, it's wonderful the way the plot kind of trips you up when, at that moment in particular, but at other moments too in this story.
It's just a perfect little slice of domestic life. I love the truthfulness in this story. The mammy, you know her. And, you know, her emotions are so turbulent, you really feel for her. There's shades of the famous Anne Enright passage from The Green Road in this, you know, of the awfulness of Christmas for women and the emotions and how high they're running. And then he turns up unannounced with the wife and she hasn't been warned. And there's a, you know, very brave twist in this story. She goes somewhere quite interesting with it. And I think the mother has to contemplate a newly multicultural family, and it's quite with quite funny results. But also I think in this story, again, back to truthfulness, there's an ageless truth, which is that once the son is well married, mammy can stop worrying about him.
Well, Dependable Mags is how the daughter is named, and then you have the son arriving with the wife. Okay, let's move on to another of the stories, Turncoat, written by David Ralph. Sheila Barrett's story, as we just heard, has a Christmas setting. David Ralph's Turncoat is narrated by a man who is hoping his relationship might make it until Christmas. Something of a clue in the title here, Claire, Turncoat. What struck you about David Ralph's story?
Show, don't tell is a rule in fiction, but this is a very literal show, don't tell. His girlfriend, stroke ex-girlfriend, he doesn't know, literally shows him what he has done to her. Dinna lum that, two-faced.
Yeah.
And it's such a clever image. And we don't usually hear it from the point of view of the guilty party, but he's kind of tiptoeing around her, trying to make pancakes. Like, he's so out of his depth that you kind of pity him, and yet he is the transgressor. It plays with all those emotions.
All right, let's hear Rory Nolan reading a section from Turncoat. And here he is, the point at which our narrator is hoping to win over his partner, a woman called Leisha, and he's going to use food.
Sometimes this terrible dread strikes me that a switch is about to be flicked and I will drop stone dead to the floor. It's the world's worst feeling. Now the feeling is flickering at the edges of my thoughts, threatening disaster. I rub at my ribs, my sternum, my neck. I love Leisha. We've made promises, plans. We've been saving hard to move south. There's the site her parents gifted her on the edge of their lake. An architect did us up blueprints. The builders are set to come in and break ground. I need to do something. There's a constriction in my chest. I step into the kitchenette. Right, I'm making your special breakfast. A smidgen of brandy into the egg milk mix is the secret to my French toast. Leisha was blown away first time she tasted it. I cut slices from the batch, soaked them in a bowl. I'm banking on us making it to Christmas, because if we make it to Christmas, then we'll make it to the new year. And if we make it to the new year, then I feel anything is possible.
A reading from Turncoat by David Ralph, and David is making his way up to speak with me now. How good are you at making French toast?
Oh, I'm a wonderful cook.
Recipe your own?
Absolutely.
So it is autobiographical, okay. I suppose the task you've set yourself here, and both the judges mentioned, is this idea that he's the transgressor, yet he's the one that we're going to listen to for the duration of the story. What kind of challenges did that set for you?
Yeah, he's betrayed his beloved, and he is trying to keep something alive that's, I suppose, beyond life support. So I was just trying to see if, you know, I could take this beyond that moment, but clearly there is no future here for them, you know, as we realize through the story. So he's flogging a dead horse.
David Ralph, thanks very much.
Right, we're going to talk to one more story before we take a short break. And this is the rehearsal by Alexis MacIsaac. And Alexis, like Emer, who we spoke to earlier on, has come from Canada, Ottawa, in Alexis's case, to be with us this evening. We're going to listen to a section from her story to start us out. Two musicians are involved here, meeting up for a rehearsal during a power cut in the area. Katrina Ní Mhuirchiú will now read from The Rehearsal by Alexis MacIsaac.
It's dark now. The blackout happened while I was waiting for my accompanist to arrive for rehearsal. Another elderly limb must have thrown itself against a power line when it dislocated from its trunk. 20 minutes later, my door swings open with a sigh, and an unexpected voice calls out from my entryway. Hello, I'm here. I follow the gravelly sound. It's Joseph, my guitarist. He's thrust his hulking body into my alcove and is so close that I can smell his livid sweat and his parched breath. I take a step back, but he takes a step closer. Joseph is a man accustomed to filling up space, as if others should contort themselves to accommodate him, an arrogance innate to large men who look down upon the rest of us. The whole block is out, he says, trees uprooted. Your neighbors are going to be pissed about their dented Teslas. Some people like being pissed. It gives them a sense of purpose.
Katrina Ní Mhuirchiú reading from The Rehearsal by Alexis MacIsaac. Kathleen, when I spoke with Alexis about this story on the programme, I mentioned the amount of tension that there is in the story. And it's all types of tension that there is in this story.
It's so physically uncomfortable, you can hear from the reading there. Mm. I mean, I think there's an ick in this story that is so wonderfully written into it. And yet there's also, you know, the singer is struggling with whether she's actually attracted to this accompanist or whether she finds him disgusting and repellent. And you're with her, and that's all echoed in the music and the tuning up, and it's very, very intense. I thought it reflected, as Claire pointed out, that theme that emerged again and again this year about male and female worlds, dissonance, and to put that in that setting with two musicians tuning up just worked brilliantly, I think.
Okay, there we have it then. We're halfway through our 10 shortlisted stories. Stay with us to hear the rest of the stories and to find out who has won the 2024 RTE Short Story Competition in honour of Francis McManus. Welcome back to the Pavilion Theatre in Dunleary. You're listening to a special arena celebrating the RTE Short Story Competition in honour of Francis McManus. God, they are lively, aren't they? We've sampled 5 of the 10 shortlisted stories at this point, and we're going to look at the next 5 now with our judges, Neil Hegarty, Claire Kilroy, and Kathleen McMahon. Once Upon an Algorithm by Ryan Delaney deals with the whole topic of AI and whether the creative writer might be replaced by a chatbot in the near, distant, middle future. Who knows? Let's hear Rory Nolan read from Ryan Delaney's Once Upon an Algorithm as writer Declan Finnegan sits at his computer.
As Declan's finger hesitated over the enter key, he felt like he was about to commit a grubby crime against the human spirit, against himself. Of course, he wasn't going to do anything with it, whatever it turned out to be. He only wanted to see what it was capable of, just once, then he'd trash it and be done with it forever. But still, it felt like the edge of a slippery slope, like when he'd started smoking again and swore that this time he'd only have 1 or 2 at the end of the week when he was out for a pint, but now he was back to 10 a day. He got up and walked in circles around the kitchen, looked out the window at a fat pigeon fluffing itself down in Mrs. Kerry's yard, then up at the evening star glowing soft and alone in the half dark. He flicked open his cigarette packet and snapped it shut again, then pounced at his computer and hit enter.
Once Upon an Algorithm There by Ryan Delaney, read by Rory Nolan. Just thinking about that story in particular, Neil, you know, I wonder how tempted, as I asked Ryan when I spoke to him, how tempted he was to just say, well, let's see what story will be thrown out at me. But this is a kind of a serious enough topic. What is the future of AI when it comes to creative writing?
AI, we keep hearing about it more and more often. What is it going to do? I really like the way that this story offered mingled comfort and menace. Comfort, because the AI in the story is cheesy. Ryan makes really good use of adverbs. A really good use of adverbs, and I love that. But underlying that, there's a sense of, well, how soon is AI going to be faultless? How soon is it going to be perfect?
You say he makes really good use of adverbs, which quite often adverbs and adjectives, you'd be told as a writer, no, get rid of those. But to be able to write badly, it's a bit like Les Dawson on the piano. To write or play badly, you have to be able to write or play very well.
Indeed, and he does it. He executes AI, I have to say, really faultlessly, L-Y.
Okay, let us move on then to story number 7 of 10. Fiona O'Connor's story, Chambermaid, is what we're going to talk about here. It's narrated by an older woman looking back at a love affair she had with a priest during a period when she was his housekeeper. This is a story... Of all the 10, it is one that experiments with form, I think, to the greatest extent, Kathleen.
Yeah, and I think in the reading of this story, I mean, all the readings are wonderful. In the reading of this story, you really hear that lovely stream of consciousness, the way words are dangling, the thoughts are coming hard and fast. It's a really interesting story. Is the housekeeper is remembering an affair she had with a priest. Again, that theme of male worlds and female worlds. And it's so well told here. There isn't even just an imbalance between the male and the female. She's a cleaner and he's a priest, so there's a power imbalance too. And her love, it seemed to me in the story, is so beautifully told, is so natural. Her love for him, this comparison made of the song of the blackbird, and his resistance to it, his duty as a priest, is so unnatural in this story.
All right, let's have a chat with Fiona O'Connor, who's with us here this evening, obviously, as well. One of the things that struck me about the story, Chambermaid, Fiona, yet this is about romantic love, but it's about forbidden romantic love. How important was that forbidden aspect of things?
Very important, and I think it is very difficult to write about love and the emotion of love. But when you have that limit or obstacle that is complete, you can then bring forwards aspects of the desire and the need and the depth. So it's the limit that makes it possible to talk about something that actually was probably quite every day between these two people in the house together domestically.
It also struck me, you've no punctuation here. We know what the sentences are. There are capital letters, but you've no full stops, no commas, no anything like that. Touch of the Molly Bloom about it. You do that in your mind?
Well, I think we were all reading James Joyce for the anniversary around the time I was writing the story. So definitely I was influenced. And I did have some punctuation, but it didn't look right when I was taking out stuff. So then it all started to come out and I just wanted to play with the possibilities of that.
All right, let's listen then to a section from Chambermaid by Fiona O'Connor, read for us by Katrina Ní Mhuirchiú.
Only a bed and a wardrobe in the small room. Crucifix over the bed. She sat on the edge of the bed, neatly made according to her own ways as a chambermaid. Years ago, she'd learned how to billow a sheet with one movement so that it lifted high onto the air and floated down evenly upon the mattress. His hands were trembling. The silver band still there, but not wearing his collar, she noticed. He hardly did these days. In a normal shirt, white shirt, with a top button open and rolled up sleeves, he stood by the edge of the bed. So, he said, murmured, really. She slumped inside at that, looked down at her shoes. She knew already what he'd say. She saw a tiny nail clipping was snagged on the pale green carpet. Crescent moon of nail, although no one had stayed in the room for months, and she hoovered it anyway every few days. This can't, Martha. We are human, she said.
Katrina Niwuraku reading from Fiona O'Connor's story, Chambermaid. Right, next we have a story called Desi and Hopper, written by Suzanne Stick, who, when she spoke to me on Arena, told me how it was an image of a cold flat, a middle-aged woman and two dogs that started this story of loneliness, isolation, themes that come up in several of the stories, Neil, and it's certainly at the heart of this story.
Desi and Hopper are despair and hope. I really liked the way that Suzanne played with the idea of the importance of the pivot in life. All our lives, we have hundreds and thousands of pivots all the time. Some of them don't amount to anything, but others send our lives off in altogether new directions. And as a middle-aged woman in a damp flat in Galway, she thinks that her life has reached its lowest ebb, its narrowest place. But there's a sense of it isn't going to end like that. There's a sense of momentum at the end if we want to see that. And I loved this story. It brought tears to my eyes every single time I read it.
It's even as you're speaking to us now, there's a little bit of a catch in your voice. Yep. An art gallery plays an important part in how this isolation is tackled for the woman in question. Katrina Niwuraku will read from Desi and Hopper for us now. And at this moment in time, our narrator, Ava, starts to open up to a woman called Gemma, who she's just met at an art exhibition.
Another one? She pointed at your glass and for some reason you nodded. When you toasted, the tinkle of glass against glass, almost unnoticeable, made you think of a pin dropping. I'm Gemma, by the way. Ava. Nice to meet you, Ava. You couldn't remember when you last blushed like this, your face lit from within. It was small talk to begin with. She'd left Dublin 30 years ago. When you mentioned Dunfanaghy, it turned out she knew someone who'd ridden a pony there in late 1970s. I spent my childhood on that beach, you said. Donegal is a dream. I can't believe you grew up there. She soon veered back into the present moment and you suddenly remembered. Ava, out for the night. The first time in forever.
Katrina Niwuraku reading from Desi and Hopper. And so let us go to the penultimate story tonight in our RTE short story competition, Divination by Stephen O'Reilly. Rory Nolan will read for us the opening section of Stephen O'Reilly's story, Divination.
Something odd in her voice on the phone and a hesitant tread downstairs late. He has just bundled their child out the door to school, pulling the coat up about small shoulders, placing a kiss on his forehead as he zips him up, the six-year-old wiping it away with an exaggerated moo that both amuses and spears. And while he stands there, becoming redundant in the narrow hallway, contemplating their child's image fading away behind frosted glass, she tells him the future is bleeding into the present. Anything he says might be foolish or inadequate, and so he concentrates on maneuvering the old car towards Galway, wiping condensation away from the windscreen with his hand, cold beads of water gathering about fingertips to drip, drip down, submerging feelings or questions before they manifest in futile words.
Rory Nolan reading from Divination by Stephen O'Reilly. One of the things that struck me, many things struck me about this particular story, Claire, it's the tenderness with which this male character is portrayed and the words that he both is given to speak and speaks to us.
Yeah, and it's very poignant because he feels excluded from his own miscarriage, you know, in the way that men have been kept away from this realm. And there's a great description. I'll read it out. This is when, during the ultrasound, and he's looking at his wife, and he says, ridiculously, he feels like a voyeur and turns away to concentrate on the monitor. So as a man, he does things like he does the car, you know, and now he looks at the screen because that's what men do. But his grief is very real. And that word submerged that we heard just there, it's about submerging your grief and why.
Yeah, and hugely emotional in terms of family life. And just the sensitivity of this narrator is extraordinary, Neil.
He's doing his best, but he, as Claire says, he feels on the edge, somewhat simultaneously central and on the edge, which is an impossibly tricky situation. And we're given access to all these feelings as they sort of unspool. It's emotionally devastating.
Let's speak with Stephen O'Reilly about his story, Divination. Stephen, the judges, both Claire and Neil, and I'm sure Kathleen would echo it, it's the emotional depth of this story as you read it or as you listen to it.
I'm in bits myself now listening. You know, it's a story about love, fundamentally, and we have two people who are going through one of those unfortunate things that happen to people, and they obviously love each other, but they've also fallen in love with the idea of another child, and it's a future that's about to wink out of existence for them. So, yeah, it's a difficult story and a dark story, but I think it's a hopeful story too.
There's certainly hope in there, but I talk about the emotion of reading it. How difficult is that to write, or do you have to get the emotion out of the way when you're writing?
It was very difficult to write. I mean, the thing is, you almost don't feel that you have a right to say these things, you know, it was very difficult. I found it very difficult. I find it very difficult now thinking about it. But yeah, you know, we're pragmatic. We're grown-ups. We move on.
Stephen O'Reilly and his story, Divination. Thank you, Stephen.
And finally, story number 10 is Artifice by Sharon Gard, who spoke with me just a few nights ago, in fact, on Arena. Loneliness, isolation again here very much, Kathleen, but in the wonderful setting of a hairdresser's.
Isn't that brilliant? It's so cleverly done. And not just the setting of a hairdresser. A woman customer is watching an employee of hair and purple. And there's so much colour in this story. The woman has red hair and purple nails. And it's very alive. She really gets so brilliantly the atmosphere in the hairdresser, the girl's acrylic nails that she's washing her hair, all that. So that really draws us in. But also, again, there's a real truth to this story. And the character is grieving. And she's gone to a different hairdresser because in the strange landscape of grief, she's seeking out anonymity and the safety of people who don't know her. And I loved that truthfulness in this story.
And family issues very much to the fore here as well. Let's listen to a section from Artifice by Sharon Gard, read for us by Katrina Niwarku.
You're not getting it cut? Another girl asks, taking a hairdryer from its holder, brandishing a brush. Well, maybe it's another girl. Maybe it's the same one. Somebody somewhere drops a tray of rollers, emits a curse. A baby cries, and you tingle. Feel the familiar rise in your innards, the catch of fright in your throat. Find your arms drawn tight to your torso, involuntarily, as if by a magnet. You focus on red, but the rest of the tableau smudges into white, grey, brown, black whirls. This happens now, a lot. Find your breath. Go slowly, they tell you. Go easy on yourself, they tell you. You need time. But when you try to take it, retreat, they worry, suggest fixes, expect you to unravel spontaneously. You tell them you're seeing a professional, taking pills simply to placate. The irony of this time needed is the amount of it you spend comforting others.
Katrina Niwarku reading from Sharon Gard's story, Artifice. Well, There you have it. That is all 10 stories. Thanks to Judges Claire Kilroy, Kathleen McMahon and Neil Hegarty for their insightful comments there. Also to Katrina Niwaraku and Rory Nolan, who brought these stories to life for us, I think, here at the Pavilion Theatre in Dunleary this evening. And most importantly of all, let us acknowledge the writers. We thank you for entering the competition. We have to salute you for recognising and capturing this small spark of an idea and for listening to it as it whispered to each of you. For staying the course, draft after draft, edit by edit, head scratch by head scratch, wondering what you're doing with your life by wondering what you're doing with your life, I'm sure, at times as well. But you did complete it. You did press send. And each one of you, all 10 of you, as I've said, being shortlisted, you are a winner for that alone. Reached the moment now, the moment of decision here on our RTE Arena short story special in honour of Frances McManus. 10 shortlisted writers want to know the results, as I'm sure you here in the pavilion and you listening at home want to as well. Each of the stories tonight has been broadcast on Radio 1. It has been published on rteculture.ie. And please, if you haven't already done so, go to RTE Culture and either read or listen to them online, or indeed do both. Each of the stories read online by 10 different actors. Tonight, we have 3 prizes to award. Third place with a prize of €3,000. Runner-up prize of €4,000, and our winner, who will receive the grand prize of €5,000. There is no other way to do this other than in reverse order. Neil Hegarty will announce and present the third prize for us.
Thank you. Few periods in our lives, I think, are as fraught as adolescence. And the story which receives third prize honours the importance and the emotional heft of these brief years. The narrator's world and she herself are brought to life with tremendous vividness and sensitivity, and we are wrapped fully in her whirl of friendship, of rivalry, and of a tentative blooming of love. For all these reasons, and with our congratulations, third prize in the RTE Short Story Competition 2024 in honour of Frances McManus goes to the author of The Other Orla, Emer O'Toole.
And congratulations to Emer O'Toole. So on to our second prize. Kathleen McMahon will announce this prize winner for us.
A beautiful account of a man's attempt to accompany his wife through the intensely female experience of miscarriage. The writer describes to great effect the gap that exists between them and the man's efforts to cross it. The use of language is gorgeous, with a glimpse at the end of a future that's hopeful. A very moving story. Our choice as the runner-up in this year's RTE Short Story Competition is Divination by Stephen O'Reilly.
And congratulations to Stephen. And so, time now to announce the overall winner and the writer who will walk away with the top prize in this year's RTE Short Story Competition worth €5,000. Judge Claire Kilroy will tell us who.
This story was fully realised. In imagining himself with such commitment into his protagonist's shoes, this writer managed the feat of putting his reader into those shoes. The atmosphere, the tension, the sense of dread gripped us throughout. What could have been an ordinary crime story was elevated at the ending by an upsurge of love. For these reasons, and with our congratulations, first prize in the RTE Short Story Competition 2024 in honour of Frances McManus goes to the author Matty Brennan for his short story, Dead Bait.
And congratulations to Matty Brennan. Congratulations to all 3 winners this evening, and indeed our other 7 shortlisted writers. A very big thank you to our 3 judges, Kathleen McMahon, Neil Hegarty and Claire Kilroy, and to our fantastic readers tonight, Rory Nolan and Katrina Niwaraku.
Our sound and tech team were Adam Faulkner, Ben Keatley, and Lucy Bracken. Our broadcast coordinator was Elaine Conlon. And tonight's programme was produced by Sarah Binchy and Reg Luby. We'll leave you now with another song from the Finches, Ooh La La Bonga.
I'm sick of listening to you. Nothing you say is ever true. I'm taking a break from passing through. I met with Walter at the Louvre. He was wearing a smile, playing didgeridoo. Heartbreak is music making on the ooh la 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 la, ooh la la bongo. Eating up the sky without a spoon. Resting in the lilies of the moon. Feeling strange.
I'm feeling kind of fruity.
On the rain.
I can't feel my teeth.
Let it float away. What you see.
I forgot to mention.
Make me free.
I'm in my own dimension.
Contemplative land. I'm sick of listening to you. Nothing you say. Ever true. I'm taking a break from passing through. I met with Walter at the Louvre. He was wearing a smile, playing didgeridoo. Heartbreak is music making on the ooh la 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 ooh la la bongo. Even when it's dark, I see you there. Put your nightshirt on, I smell you.
When we say ooh la la, I want to hear you say a bongo.